like Yamamoto. I might not be able to avoid being killed in the end, but not like that. I was alive for now. I was still breathing, and if what the Russian officer had said was true, I would not be killed straight away. The more time that lay between me and death, the more chance I had to survive. It might be a minuscule chance, but all I could do was cling to it. Then, all of a sudden, the words of Corporal Honda flared to life again in my brain. That strange prognostication of his that I would not die on the continent. Even as I sat there, tied to the saddle, the skin of my naked back burning in the desert sun, I savored every syllable that he had spoken over and over again. I let myself dwell on his expression, his intonation, the sound of each word, and I resolved to believe him from the bottom of my heart. No, no, I was not going to lie down and die in a place like this. I would come out of this alive. I would tread my native soil once again. We traveled north for 2 hours or more, coming to a stop near a Lamaist devotional mound. These stone markers, called Obu, serve both as the guardian deity for travelers and as valuable signposts in the desert. Here the men dismounted and untied my ropes. Supporting my weight on either side, two of them led me a short distance. I figured that this was where I would be killed. A well had been dug into the earth here. The mouth of the well was surrounded by a 3-foot-high stone curb. They made me kneel down beside it, grabbed my neck from behind, and forced me to look inside. I couldn't see a thing in the impenetrable darkness. The non-com with the boots found a fist-sized rock and dropped it into the well. Sometime later came the dry sound of stone hitting sand. So the well was a dry one, apparently. It had once served as a well in the desert, but it must have dried up long before, owing to a movement of the subterranean vein of water. Judging from the time it took the stone to hit the bottom, it seemed to be quite deep. The non-com looked at me with a big grin. Then he took a large automatic pistol from the leather holster on his belt. He released the safety and fed a bullet into the chamber with a loud click. Then he put the muzzle of the gun against my head. He held it there for a long time, but did not pull the trigger. Then he slowly lowered the gun and raised his left hand, pointing towards the well. Licking my dry lips, I stared at the gun in his fist. What he was trying to tell me was this. I had a choice between two fates. I could have him shoot me now, just die and get it over with. Or I could jump into the well. Because it was so deep, if I landed badly, I might be killed. If not, I would die slowly at the bottom of a dark hole. At last it dawned on me that this was the chance the Russian officer had spoken of. The Mongolian non-com pointed at the watch that he had taken from Yamamoto and held up 5 fingers. He was giving me 5 seconds to decide. When he got to 3, I stepped onto the well curb and leaped inside. I had no choice. I had hoped to be able to cling to the wall and work my way down, but he gave me no time for that. My hands missed the wall and I tumbled down. It seemed to take a very long time for me to hit the bottom. In reality, it could not have been more than a few seconds, but I do recall thinking about a great many things on my way down. I thought about my hometown so far away. I thought about the girl I slept with just once before they shipped me out. I thought about my parents. I recall feeling grateful that I had a younger sister and not a brother. Even if I was killed, they would still have her and not have to worry about her being taken by the army. I thought about rice cakes wrapped in oak leaves. Then I slammed into dry ground and lost consciousness for a moment. It felt as if all the air inside me had burst through the walls of my body. I thudded against the well bottom like a sandbag. I believe that I lost consciousness from the impact for just a moment. When I came to, I felt some kind of spray hitting me. At first I thought it was rain, but I was wrong. It was urine. The Mongolian soldiers were all peeing on me where I lay in the bottom of the well. I looked up to see them in silhouette far above me, taking turns to come to the edge of the round hole to pee. There was a terrible unreality to the sight, like a drug-induced hallucination. But it was real. I was really in the bottom of the well, and they were spraying me with real pee. Once they had finished, someone shone a torch on me. I heard them laughing, and then they disappeared from the edge of the hole. After that, everything sank into a deep silence. For a while I thought it best to lie there face down, waiting to see if they would come back. But after 20 minutes had gone by, then 30 as far as I could tell without a watch, they did not come back. They had gone away and left me, it seemed. I had been abandoned at the bottom of a well in the middle of the desert. Once it was clear that they would not be returning, I decided to check myself over for injuries. In the darkness, this was not easy. I couldn't see my own body. I couldn't tell with my own eyes what condition it was in. I could only resort to touch. But I could not be sure that the perceptions I was experiencing in the darkness were accurate. I felt that I was being deceived, deluded. It was a very strange feeling. Little by little, though, and with great attention to detail, I began to grasp my situation. The first thing I realized was that I had been extremely lucky. The bottom of the well was relatively soft and sandy. If it hadn't been, then the impact of falling such a distance would have broken every bone in my body. I took one long, deep breath and tried to move. First, I tried moving my fingers. They responded, although feebly. Then I tried to raise myself to a sitting position, but this I was unable to do. My body felt as if it had lost all sensation. My mind was conscious, but there was something wrong with the connection between my mind and my body. My mind would decide to do something, but it was unable to convert the thought into muscular activity. I gave up, and for a while, lay there silent in the dark. Just how long I remained still, I have no idea. But little by little, my perceptions began to return. And along with the recovery of my perceptions, naturally enough, came the sensation of pain. Intense pain. Almost certainly my leg was broken, and my shoulder might be dislocated, or perhaps, if luck was against me, even broken. I lay still, enduring the pain. Before I knew it, tears were streaming down my cheeks, tears of pain and even more tears of despair. I don't think you will ever be able to understand what it is like, the utter loneliness, the feeling of desperation, to be abandoned in a deep well in the middle of the desert at the edge of the world, overcome with intense pain in total darkness. I went so far as to regret that the Mongolian non-com had not simply shot me and got it over with. If I had been killed that way, at least they would have been aware of my death. If I died here, however, it would be a truly lonely death, a death of no concern to anyone, a silent death. Now and then, I heard the sound of the wind. As it moved across the surface of the earth, the wind made an uncanny sound at the mouth of the well, a sound like the moan of a woman in tears in a far-off world. That world and this were joined by a narrow shaft, through which the woman's voice reached me, though only at long, irregular intervals. I had been left all alone, in deep silence, and even deeper darkness. Enduring the pain, I reached out to touch the earthen floor around me. The well bottom was flat. It was not very wide, maybe 5 or 5.5 feet. As I was groping the ground, my hand suddenly came upon a hard, sharp object. In fear, I drew my hand back, but then slowly and carefully, I reached out towards the thing. Again, my fingers came into contact with the sharp object. At first, I thought it was a tree branch. But soon enough, I realized I was touching bones. Not human bones, but those of a small animal, which had been scattered at random, either by the passage of time or by my fall. There was nothing else at the bottom of the well, just sand, fine and dry. Next, I ran my palm over the wall. It seemed to be made of thin, flat stones. As hot as the desert surface became in daytime, the heat did not penetrate to this world below ground. The stones had an icy chill to them. I ran my hand over the wall, examining the gaps between the stones. If I could get a foothold there, I might be able to climb to the surface. But the gaps turned out to be too narrow for that, and in my battered state, climbing seemed all but impossible. With a tremendous effort, I dragged myself closer to the wall and raised myself against it into a sitting position. Every move made my leg and shoulder throb as if they had been stuck with hundreds of thick needles. For a while after that, each breath made me feel that my body might crack apart. I touched my shoulder and realized it was hot and swollen. How much time went by after that, I do not know. But at one point something happened that I would never have imagined. The light of the sun shot down from the opening of the well like some kind of revelation. In that instant, I could see everything around me. The well was filled with brilliant light, a flood of light. The brightness was almost stifling. I could hardly breathe. The darkness and cold were swept away in a moment, and warm, gentle sunlight enveloped my naked body. Even the pain I was feeling seemed to be blessed by the light of the sun, which now warmly illuminated the white bones of the small animal beside me. These bones, which could have been an omen of my own impending fate, seemed in the sunlight more like a comforting companion. I could see the stone walls that encircled me. As long as I remained in the light, I was able to forget about my fear and pain and despair. I sat in the dazzling light in blank amazement. Then the light disappeared as suddenly as it had come. Deep darkness enveloped everything once again. The whole interval had been extremely short. In terms of the clock, it must have lasted 10 or at most 15 seconds. No doubt because of the angles involved, this was all the sun could manage to shine straight down to the bottom of the hole in any single day. The flood of sunlight was gone before I could begin to comprehend its meaning. After the light faded, I found myself in an even deeper darkness than before. I was all but unable to move. I had no water, no food, not a scrap of clothing on my body. The long afternoon went by, and night came when the temperature plunged. I could hardly sleep. My body craved sleep, but the cold pricked my skin like a thousand tiny thorns. I felt as if my life's core were stiffening and dying bit by bit. Above me I could see stars frozen in the sky, terrifying numbers of stars. I stared up at them, watching as they slowly crept along. Their movement helped me ascertain that time was continuing to flow. I slept for a short while, awoke with the cold and pain, slept a little more, then woke again. Eventually morning came. From the round mouth of the well, the sharp pinpoints of starlight gradually began to fade. Still, even after dawn broke, the stars did not completely disappear. Faint, almost to the point of imperceptibility, they continued to linger. To slake my thirst, I licked the morning dew that clung to the stone wall. The amount of water was minute, of course, but to me it tasted like a bounty from heaven. The thought crossed my mind that I had had neither food nor water for an entire day, and yet I had no sense of hunger. I remained there, still in the bottom of the hole. It was all I could do. I couldn't even think, so profound were my feelings of loneliness and despair. I sat there doing nothing, thinking nothing. Unconsciously, however, I waited for that ray of light, that blinding flood of sunlight that poured straight down to the bottom of the well for one tiny fraction of the day. It must have been a phenomenon that occurred very close to noon, when the sun was at the highest point in the sky and its light struck the surface of the earth at right angles. I waited for the coming of the light and for nothing else. There was nothing else I could wait for. A very long time went by, it seems. At some point I drifted into sleep. By the time I sensed the presence of something and awoke, the light was already there. I realized that I was being enveloped once again by that overwhelming light. Without thinking, I spread open both my hands and received the sun in my palms. It was far stronger than it had been the first time, and it lasted far longer. At least it felt that way to me. In the light, tears poured out of me. I felt as if all the fluids of my body might turn into tears and come streaming from my eyes, that my body itself might melt away. If it could have happened in the bliss of this marvelous light, even death would have been no threat. Indeed, I felt I wanted to die. I experienced a wonderful sense of oneness, an overwhelming sense of unity. Yes, that was it. The true meaning of life resided in that light that lasted for however many seconds it was, and I felt I ought to die right then and there. But, of course, before anything could happen, the light was gone. I was still in the bottom of that miserable well. Darkness and cold reasserted their grip on me, as if to declare that the light had never existed at all. For a long time I remained huddled where I was, my face bathed in tears. As if beaten down by some huge power, I was unable to do or even to think anything at all, unable to feel even my own physical existence. I was a dried-up carcass, the cast-off shell of an insect. But then, once again, into the empty room of my mind, returned the prophecy of Corporal Honda. I would not die on the continent. Now, after the light had come and gone, I found myself able to believe his prophecy. I could believe it now because in a place where I should have died, and at a time when I should have died, I had been unable to die. It was not that I would not die. I could not die. Do you understand what I am saying, Mr. Okada? Whatever heavenly grace I may have enjoyed until that moment was lost forever.
At this point in his story, Lieutenant Mamiya looked at his watch.
And as you can see,
he added softly,
here I am.
He shook his head as if trying to sweep away the invisible threads of memory.
Just as Mr. Honda had said, I did not die on the continent. And of the four of us who went there, I have lived the longest.
I nodded in response.
Please forgive me for talking at such length. It must have been very boring for you listening to a useless old man chatter on about the old days.
Lieutenant Mamiya shifted his position on the sofa.
My goodness, I'll be late for my train if I stay any longer.
I hastened to restrain him. Please don't end your story there, I said. What happened after that? I want to hear the rest. He looked at me for a moment.
How about this, then?
He asked.
I really am running late, so why don't you walk with me to the bus stop? I can give you a quick summary along the way.
I left the house with him and walked to the bus stop.
On the third morning, I was saved by Corporal Honda. He had sensed that the Mongols were coming for us that night, slipped out of the tent and remained in hiding all that time. He had taken the document from Yamamoto's bag with him. He did this because our number one priority was to see to it that the document did not fall into enemy hands, no matter how great the sacrifice we had to make. No doubt you are wondering why, if he realized that the Mongols were coming, Corporal Honda ran away by himself instead of waking the rest of us so that we could escape together. The simple fact of the matter is that we had no hope of winning in such a situation. They knew that we were there. It was their territory. They had us far outnumbered and outgunned. It would have been the simplest thing in the world for them to find us, kill us, and take the document. Given the situation, Corporal Honda had no choice but to escape by himself. On the battlefield, his actions would have been a clear case of desertion, but on a special assignment like ours, the most important thing is resourcefulness. He saw everything that happened. He watched them skinning Yamamoto. He saw the Mongolian soldiers take me away. But he no longer had a horse, so he could not follow right then. He had to come on foot. He dug up the extra supplies that we had buried in the desert, and there he buried the document. Then he came after me. For him to find me down in the well, though, required a tremendous effort. He didn't even know which direction we had taken.
How did he find the well? I asked.
I don't know,
said Lieutenant Mamiya.
He didn't say much about that. He just knew, I'd say. When he found me, he tore his clothing into strips and made a long rope. By then I was practically unconscious, which made it all the more difficult for him to pull me up. Then he managed to find a horse and put me on it. He took me across the dunes, across the river, and to the Manchu Kuo army outpost. There they treated my wounds and put me on a truck sent out by headquarters. I was taken to the hospital in Haila.
Whatever happened to that document or letter or whatever it was?
It's probably still there, sleeping in the earth near the Kalka River. For Corporal Honda and me to go all the way back and dig it up would have been out of the question, nor could we find any reason to make such an effort. We arrived at the conclusion that such a thing should never have existed in the first place. We coordinated our stories for the army investigation. We decided to insist that we had heard nothing about any document. Otherwise, they would have held us responsible for not bringing it back from the desert. They kept us in separate rooms, under strict guard, supposedly for medical treatment, and they questioned us every day. All these high-ranking officers would come and make us tell our stories over and over again. Their questions were meticulous and very clever. But they seemed to believe us. I told them every little detail of what I had experienced, being careful to omit anything I knew about the document. Once they got it all down, they warned me that this was a top-secret matter that would not appear in the Army's formal records, that I was never to mention it to anyone, and that I would be severely punished if I did. 2 weeks later, I was sent back to my original post, and I believe that Corporal Honda was also returned to his home unit.
"One thing is still not clear to me," I said. "Why did they go to the trouble of bringing Mr. Honda from his unit for this assignment?"
"He never said much to me about that. He had probably been forbidden to tell anyone, and I suspect that he thought it would be better for me not to know. Judging from my conversations with him, though, I imagine there was some kind of personal relationship between him and the man they call Yamamoto, something that had to do with his special powers. I had often heard that the Army had a unit devoted to the study of the occult. Allegedly, they gathered people with these spiritual or psychokinetic powers from all over the country and conducted experiments on them. I suspect that Mr. Honda met Yamamoto in that connection. In any case, without those powers of his, Mr. Honda would never have been able to find me in the well and guide me to the exact location of the Manchukuo army outpost. He had neither map nor compass, yet he was able to direct us straight there without the slightest uncertainty. Common sense would have told you that such a thing was impossible. I was a professional mapmaker, and I knew the geography of that area quite well, but I could never have done what he did. These powers of Mr. Honda were probably what Yamamoto was looking to him for.
We reached the bus stop and waited.
Certain things will always remain riddles, of course,
said Lieutenant Mamiya.
There are many things I still don't understand. I still wonder who that lone Mongolian officer was who met us in the desert, and I wonder what would have happened if we had managed to bring that document back to headquarters. Why did Yamamoto not simply leave us on the right bank of the Kalka and cross over by himself? He would have been able to move far more freely that way. Perhaps he had been planning to use us as a decoy for the Mongolian troops so that he could escape alone. It is conceivable. Perhaps Corporal Honda realized this from the start, and that was why he merely stood by while the Mongolians killed him. In any case, it was a very long time after that before Corporal Honda and I had an opportunity to meet again. We were separated from the moment we arrived in Hailar and were forbidden to speak or even to see each other. I had wanted to thank him one last time, but they made that impossible. He was wounded in the battle for Nomonhan and sent home, while I remained in Manchuria until the end of the war, after which I was sent to Siberia. I was only able to find him several years later, after I was repatriated from my Siberian internment. We did manage to meet a few times after that, and we corresponded. But he seemed to avoid talking about what had happened to us at the Kalka River, and I myself was not too eager to discuss it. For both of us, it had simply been too enormous an experience. We shared it by not talking about it. Does this make any sense? This has turned into a very long story, but what I wanted to convey to you was my feeling that real life may have ended for me deep in that well in the desert of Outer Mongolia. I feel as if in the intense light that shone for a mere 10 or 15 seconds a day in the bottom of the well, I burned up the very core of my life until there was nothing left. That is how mysterious that light was to me. I can't explain it very well, but as honestly and simply as I can state it, no matter what I have encountered, no matter what I have experienced since then, I ceased to feel anything in the bottom of my heart. Even in the face of those monstrous Soviet tank units, even when I lost this left hand of mine, even in the hellish Soviet internment camps, a kind of numbness was all I felt. It may sound strange to say this, but none of that mattered. Something inside me was already dead. Perhaps, as I felt at the time, I should have died in that light, simply faded away. That was the time for me to die. But as Mr. Honda had predicted, I did not die there. Or perhaps I should say that I could not die there. I came back to Japan having lost my hand and 12 precious years. By the time I arrived in Hiroshima, my parents and my sister were long since dead. They had put my little sister to work in a factory, which was where she was when the bomb fell. My father was on his way to see her at the time, and he, too, lost his life. The shock sent my mother to her deathbed. She finally passed away in 1947. As I told you earlier, the girl to whom I had been secretly engaged was now married to another man, and she had given birth to 2 children. In the cemetery, I found my own grave. There was nothing left for me. I felt truly empty, and knew that I should not have come back there. I can hardly remember what my life has been like since then. I became a social studies teacher and taught geography and history in high school, but I was not, in the true sense of the word, alive. I simply performed the mundane tasks that were handed to me one after another. I never had a single real friend, no human ties with the students in my charge. I never loved anyone. I no longer knew what it meant to love another person. I would close my eyes and see Yamamoto being skinned alive. I dreamed about it over and over. Again and again I watched them peel the skin off and turn him into a lump of flesh. I could hear his heart-rending screams. I also had dreams of myself slowly rotting away alive in the bottom of the well. Sometimes it seemed to me that that was what had really happened, and that my life here was the dream. When Mr. Honda told me on the bank of the Kalka River that I would not die on the continent, I was overjoyed. It was not a matter of believing or not believing. I wanted to cling to something then, anything at all. Mr. Honda probably knew that and told me what he did in order to comfort me. But there was to be no joy for me. After returning to Japan, I lived like an empty shell. Living like an empty shell is not really living, no matter how many years it may go on. The heart and flesh of an empty shell give birth to nothing more than the life of an empty shell. This is what I hope I have made clear to you, Mr. Okada.
Does this mean, I ventured, that you never married after returning to Japan?
Of course not, answered Lieutenant Mamiya. I have no wife, no parents or siblings. I am entirely alone.
After hesitating a moment, I asked, Are you sorry that you ever heard Mr. Honda's prediction? Now it was Lieutenant Mamiya's turn to hesitate. After a moment of silence, he looked me straight in the face.
Maybe I am, he said. Maybe he should never have spoken those words. Maybe I should never have heard them. As Mr. Honda said at the time, a person's destiny is something you look back at afterwards, not something to be known in advance. I do believe this, however. It now makes no difference either way. All I am doing is fulfilling my obligation to go on living.
The bus came, and Lieutenant Mamiya favored me with a deep bow. Then he apologized for having taken up my valuable time.
Well then, I shall be on my way, he said. Thank you for everything. I am glad in any case that I was able to hand you the package from Mr. Honda. This means that my job is done at last. I can go home with an easy mind.
Using both his right hand and the artificial one, he deftly produced the necessary coins and dropped them into the fare box. I stood there and watched as the bus disappeared around the corner. After it was gone, I felt a strange emptiness inside, a hopeless kind of feeling like that of a small child who's been left alone in an unfamiliar neighborhood. Then I went home, and sitting on the living room couch, I opened the package that Mr. Honda had left me as a keepsake. I worked up a sweat removing layer after layer of carefully sealed wrapping paper until a sturdy, cardboard box emerged. It was a fancy Cutty Sark gift box, but it was too light to contain a bottle of whiskey. I opened it to find nothing inside. It was absolutely empty. All that Mr. Honda had left me was an empty box. Book 2. Bird as Prophet. July to October 1984. 1. As concrete as possible. Appetite in literature. Kumiko didn't come back that night. I stayed up until midnight reading, listening to music, and waiting for her, but finally I gave up and went to bed. I fell asleep with the light on. It was 6 in the morning when I woke. The full light of day shone outside the window. Beyond the thin curtain, birds were chirping. There was no sign of my wife. The white pillow lay there, high and fluffy. As far as I could make out, no head had rested on it during the night. Her freshly washed, neatly folded summer pajamas lay on top of the night table. I had washed them. I had folded them. I turned off the lamp beside my pillow and took a deep breath, as if to regulate the flow of time. I did a tour of the house in my pajamas. I went first to the kitchen, then surveyed the living room, and looked into Kumiko's room. I checked the bathroom, and just to make sure, tried the cupboards. There was no sign of her anywhere. The house seemed more hushed than usual. I felt as if by moving around, I alone was to blame for disrupting the quiet harmony of the place, and for no good reason. There was nothing more for me to do. I went to the kitchen, filled the kettle, and lit the gas. When the water boiled, I made coffee and sat at the kitchen table to take a sip. Then I made toast and ate some potato salad from the refrigerator. This was the first time in years that I had eaten breakfast alone. Come to think of it, apart from a single business trip, we had never once missed breakfast together in all the time since our marriage. We had often missed lunch, and sometimes even dinner, but never breakfast. We had a tacit understanding about breakfast. It was almost a ritual for us. No matter how late we might go to bed, we would always get up early enough to fix a proper morning meal and take the time to enjoy it together. But that morning, Kumiko was gone. I drank my coffee and ate my toast alone, in silence. An empty chair was all I had to look at. I looked and ate and thought about the cologne that she had been wearing the morning before. I thought about the man who might have given it to her. I thought about her lying in a bed somewhere with him, their arms wrapped around each other. I saw his hands caressing her naked body. I saw the porcelain of her back as I had seen it in the morning, the smooth skin beneath the rising zip. The coffee seemed to have a soapy taste. I couldn't quite believe it. Shortly after the first sip, I sensed an unpleasant aftertaste. I wondered if my feelings were playing tricks on me. But the second sip had the same taste. I emptied the cup into the sink and poured myself more coffee in a clean cup. Again, the taste of soap. I couldn't imagine why. I'd washed the pot well, and there was nothing wrong with the water. But the taste, or smell, was unmistakable. It could only have been soap, or possibly moisturizing lotion. I threw away the coffee and started to boil some more water, but it just wasn't worth the trouble. I filled a cup with water from the tap and drank that instead. I really didn't want coffee all that much anyway. I waited until 9:30 and dialed Kumiko's office. A woman answered the phone.
"May I speak to Kumiko Okada?" I asked.
"I'm sorry, but she doesn't seem to be here yet."
I thanked her and hung up. Then I started ironing shirts, as I always did when I felt restless. When I ran out of shirts, I tied up old newspapers and magazines, wiped down the sink and cabinet shelves, cleaned the toilet and bathtub. I polished the mirrors and windows, I unscrewed the ceiling fixtures and washed the frosted glass. I stripped the sheets and threw them in the washing machine, then put on fresh ones. At 11 o'clock, I called the office again. The same girl answered, and again she told me that Kumiko had not come in.
"Was she planning to miss work today?" I asked.
"Not to my knowledge," she said, without a trace of feeling.
She was just reporting the facts. Something was wrong if Kumiko had still not reported to work at 11 o'clock. Most publishers' offices kept irregular hours, but not Kumiko's. Producing magazines on health and natural foods, they had to deal with the kind of writers and other professionals, food producers, farmers, doctors, who went to work early in the morning and came home late in the evening. To accommodate them, Kumiko and her colleagues reported to the company at 9 o'clock sharp and left by 5, unless there was some special reason to stay later. Hanging up, I went to the bedroom and looked through her wardrobe. If she had run off, Kumiko should have taken her clothes. I checked the dresses and blouses and skirts that were hanging there. Of course, I didn't know every piece of clothing she owned. I didn't know every piece of clothing that I owned, but I often took her things to the cleaners and picked them up for her, so I had a pretty good grasp of which items she wore most often and which were most important to her, and as far as I could tell, just about everything was there. Besides, she had had no opportunity to take a lot of clothes with her. I tried to recall as precisely as possible her departure from the house the day before, the clothes she wore, the bag she carried. All she had had with her was the shoulder bag she always carried to work, stuffed with notebooks and cosmetics and her wallet and pens and a handkerchief and tissues. A change of clothing would never have fit inside. I looked through her drawers. Accessories, stockings, sunglasses, panties, cotton tops, everything was there, arranged in neat rows. If anything had disappeared, it was impossible for me to tell. Panties and stockings, of course, she could have managed to take in her shoulder bag, but come to think of it, why would she have bothered? Those she could have picked up anywhere. I went back to the bathroom for another look. No sign of change there either, just a lot of little cosmetics containers and accessories. I opened the bottle of Christian Dior cologne and took another sniff. It smelled the same as before, the fragrance of a white flower, perfect for a summer morning. Again I thought of her ears and her white back. I went to the living room and stretched out on the sofa. I closed my eyes and listened. Virtually the only sound I could hear was that of the clock ticking off time. There were no car noises or birds chirping. I had no idea what to do now. I decided to call her office again and got as far as lifting the receiver and dialing the first few numbers, but the thought of having to talk to that same girl was too much for me, and I put the receiver back.
There was nothing more for me to do.
I could only wait. Perhaps Kumiko was leaving me. For what reason, I did not know, but it was at least a possibility. Even if it was true, though, she was not the kind of person who would leave without a word. She would do her best to explain her exact reasons as precisely as possible. Of that, I was 100% certain. Or, then, there might have been an accident. She might have been run over by a car and rushed to hospital. She could be unconscious at that very moment, receiving a transfusion. The thought made my heart pound, but I knew that she was carrying her driving license and credit cards and address book. The hospital or the police would have contacted me by now. I went to sit on the veranda and look at the garden, but didn't look at anything. I tried to think, but I couldn't concentrate on any one thing. All that came to mind, again and again, was Kumiko's back as I raised the zip of her dress, her back, and the smell of the cologne behind her ears. Just after 1 o'clock, the phone rang. I stood up from the sofa and picked up the receiver.
"Excuse me, but would this be Mr. Okada's home?"
asked a woman's voice. It was Multicano.
"That's right," I said.
"My name is Multicano. I'm calling about the cat."
"The cat?" I said with some confusion. I'd forgotten all about it. Now, of course, I remembered, but it seemed like something from an age ago.
"The cat that Mrs. Okada was searching for,"
Multicano explained.
"Sure, sure," I said.
Multicano fell silent, as if gauging something. My tone of voice might have put her on the alert. I cleared my throat and shifted the receiver to my other hand. After a short pause, Multicano said,
"I must tell you, Mr. Okada, I believe that the cat will almost certainly never be found. I hate to say this, but the best you can do is resign yourself to the fact. It is gone forever. Barring some major change, the cat will never come back."
"Some major change?" I asked.
But she did not respond. Multicano remained silent for a long time. I waited for her to say something, but try as I might, I could not hear the smallest breath from her end. Just as I was beginning to suspect that the telephone was out of order, she began to speak again.
"It may be terribly rude of me to say this, Mr. Okada, but apart from the cat, isn't there perhaps something else for which I can be of help?"
I could not reply to her immediately. With the receiver in my hand, I leaned back against the wall. It took some time for the words to come.
"Things are still not very clear to me," I said. "I don't know anything for sure. I'm trying to work it out in my own mind, but I think my wife has left me."
I explained to her that Kumiko had not come home the night before or reported to work that morning. She seemed to be mulling this over.
"You must be very worried," she said. "There is nothing I can say at this point, but things should become clear before too long. Now all you can do is wait. It must be hard for you, but there is a right time for everything, like the ebb and flow of the tides. No one can do anything to change them. When it is time to wait, you must wait."
"Look, Miss Kano, I'm grateful for the trouble you've taken with the cat, but right now I'm not in the mood for smooth-sounding generalities. I'm feeling lost, really lost. Something awful is going to happen. I feel it, but I don't know what to do. I have absolutely no idea what I should do. Is that clear? I don't even know what I should do after this call. What I need right now is facts, concrete facts. I don't care how stupid and simple they might be, I'll take any facts I can get. Am I making myself clear? I need something I can see and touch."
Down the phone I heard the sound of something falling on the floor. Something not very heavy, perhaps a single pearl, dropping onto a wooden floor. This was followed by a rubbing sound as if a piece of tracing paper were being held in someone's fingertips and given a vigorous yank. These movements seemed to be occurring somewhere neither very close to nor far from the telephone, but they were apparently of no interest to Multicano.
"I see,"
she said in a flat, expressionless voice.
"Something concrete."
"That's right, as concrete as possible."
wait for a phone call. Waiting for a phone call is all I've been doing. You should be getting a call soon from a person whose name begins with O.
Does this person know something about Kumiko?
That I can't say. I'm just telling you this because you said you would take any concrete facts you could get. And here is another one. Before very long, a half moon will last for several days.
A half moon? I asked. You mean the moon in the sky?
Yes, Mr. Okada, the moon in the sky. In any case, the thing for you to do is wait. Waiting is everything. Goodbye, then. I'll be talking to you again soon.
And she hung up. I fetched our address book from my desk and opened it at the O's. There were precisely four listings, written in Kumiko's neat little hand. The first was my father, Tadao Okada. Then came an old college friend of mine named Onoda, a dentist named Otsuka, and the local Omura off-license. I could forget about the off-license. It was 10 minutes' walk from the house, and apart from those rare instances where we would order a case of beer to be delivered, we had no particular dealings with them. The dentist was also irrelevant. I had gone to him for work on a molar 2 years earlier, but Kumiko had never been there. In fact, she had never been to any dentist since she married me. My friend Onoda I hadn't seen in years. He had gone to work for a bank after college, was transferred to the Sapporo branch in his second year, and had been living in Hokkaido ever since. Now he was just one of those people I exchanged New Year's cards with. I couldn't remember whether he had ever met Kumiko. That left my father. But it was unthinkable that Kumiko would have some special relationship with him. He'd remarried after my mother's death, and I had not seen him or corresponded with him or spoken to him on the telephone in the years since. Kumiko had never even met the man. Flipping through the address book, I was reminded how little the two of us had had to do with other people. Apart from a few useful meetings with colleagues, we had had almost no relationships outside the house in the 6 years since our marriage, but instead had lived a withdrawn sort of life. Just Kumiko and me. I decided to make spaghetti for lunch again. Not that I was the least bit hungry, but I couldn't just go on sitting on the sofa waiting for the phone to ring. I had to move my body, to begin working towards some goal. I put water in a pot, turned on the gas, and until it boiled, made tomato sauce while listening to an FM broadcast. The radio was playing an unaccompanied violin sonata by Bach. The performance itself was excellent, but there was something annoying about it. I didn't know whether this was the fault of the violinist or of my own state of mind, but I turned off the music and went on cooking in silence. I heated the olive oil, threw in some garlic, and added chopped onions. When these began to brown, I added the tomatoes that I had chopped and strained. It was good to be cutting things and frying things like this. It gave me a sense of accomplishment that I could feel in my hands. I liked the sounds and the smells. When the water boiled, I put in the salt and a fistful of spaghetti. I set the timer for 10 minutes and washed the things in the sink. Even with the finished spaghetti on the plate in front of me, though, I felt no desire to eat. I barely managed to finish half and threw out the rest. The leftover sauce I put in a container and stored in the refrigerator. Oh, well, the appetite had not been there to begin with. Long before, I seemed to recall, I had read some kind of story about a man who keeps eating while he waits for something to happen. After thinking long and hard about it, I concluded that it was from Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms. The hero, I had forgotten his name, manages to escape from Italy to Switzerland by boat, and while waiting in this little Swiss town for his wife to give birth, he constantly goes to the cafe across the way for something to drink or eat. I could hardly remember anything about the plot. What had stuck in my mind was this one part near the end, in which the hero goes from meal to meal while waiting in a foreign country for his wife to have her baby. The reason I recalled it so clearly, it seemed, was that this part of the book had an intense reality to it. It seemed far more real to me as literature for the character's anxiety to cause this abnormal surge in appetite, rather than to make him incapable of eating and drinking. In contrast to A Farewell to Arms, though, I developed no appetite at all as I watched the hands of the clock in this quiet house, waiting for something to happen. And soon the thought crossed my mind that my failure to develop an appetite might be owing to the lack within me of this kind of literary reality. I felt as if I had become part of a badly written novel, that someone was taking me to task for being utterly unreal. And perhaps it was true. The phone finally rang just before 2 in the afternoon.
"Is this the Okada residence?"
asked an unfamiliar male voice. It was a young man's voice, low and smooth.
"Yes, it is," I answered, my voice somewhat tense.
"Block 2, number 26?
"That's right."
"This is the Omura off-license calling. Thank you for your continued patronage. I was just about to leave to collect payments, and I wanted to check to see if this was a good time for you."
"Payments?"
"Yes, sir. I have you down for 2 cases of beer and a case of juice."
"Oh, fine. I'll be at home for a while yet," I said, bringing our conversation to a close. After hanging up, I wondered whether that conversation had contained any information regarding Kumiko. But viewed from all possible angles, it had been nothing but a short, practical call from an off-license. I had ordered beer and juice from them, and they had delivered it. That was certain. Half an hour later, the fellow came to the door, and I paid for 2 cases of beer and a case of juice. The friendly young man smiled as he filled out the receipt.
"By the way, Mr. Okada, did you hear about the accident by the station this morning, about 9:30?
"Accident?" I asked with a shock. "Who was in an accident?"
"A little girl," he said. "Got run over by a reversing van. Badly hurt, too, I hear. I got there just after it happened. It's awful to see something like that first thing in the morning. Little kids scare the heck out of me. You can't see them in your rear-view mirror. You know the cleaners by the station? It happened right in front of his place. People park their bikes there and all these boxes are piled up. You can't see a thing."
After he left, I felt I couldn't stay in the house a minute longer. All of a sudden, the place felt hot and stuffy, dark and cramped. I put on my shoes and got out of there as fast as I could. I didn't even lock the door. I left the windows open and the kitchen light on. I wandered around the neighborhood, sucking on a lemon drop. As I replayed the words of the young off-license employee in my mind, it slowly dawned on me that I had left some clothes at the cleaners by the station. Kumiko's blouse and skirt. The ticket was in the house. But if I just went and asked for them, the man would probably let me have them. The neighborhood looked a little different. The people I passed on the street all had an unnatural, even artificial look. I examined each face as I walked by, and I wondered what kind of people these could be. What kind of houses did they live in? What kind of families did they have? What kind of lives did they lead? Did they sleep with women other than their wives? Or men other than their husbands? Were they happy? Did they know how unnatural and artificial they looked? Signs of the morning's accident were still visible outside the cleaners. On the ground, the police chalk line. Nearby, a few shoppers discussing the accident with grave expressions on their faces. Inside, the cleaner's shop looked the same as ever. The same black music machine played the same kind of mood music, while in the back an old-fashioned air conditioner roared along and clouds of steam rose from the iron to the ceiling. The song was Ebb Tide, Robert Maxwell, Harp. I thought how wonderful it would be if I could go to the ocean. I imagined the smell of the beach and the sound of waves breaking on the shore, seagulls, ice-cold cans of beer. To the owner I said only that I had forgotten my receipt. "I'm pretty sure I brought them in last Friday or Saturday, a blouse and a skirt."
Okada. Okada,
he said, and flipped through the pages of a college notebook.
Sure, here it is, one blouse, one skirt, but Mrs. Okada picked them up already.
She did? I asked, taken aback.
Yesterday morning I distinctly remember handing